This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib coming up on Africa News Tonight.
If every economic issue is framed as a struggle between a hardworking white middle class and an undeserving minority, then workers of all shades are going to be left fighting for scraps while the wealthy withdraw further into their private enclaves.
That's U.S. President Barack Obama delivering his farewell address to the nation from Chicago. Details next.
Also, Gambian President Yahya Jammeh remains defiant, rejecting calls to step down when his term ends next week.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Well, 10 days before he departs the White House and becomes a private citizen, U.S. President Barack Obama delivered his farewell address to the nation. The president used the Tuesday night speech to highlight his administration's achievements during the past 8 years and to warn about the risks to American democracy from divisiveness and political animosity. VOA's Richard Green has more on the final speech of a historic presidency.
President Barack Obama was greeted by a large and enthusiastic crowd in his adopted hometown of Chicago, where his political career began more than two decades ago.
It's good to be home!
The president said the United States is a better, stronger place than when he took office in 2009.
If I had told you 8 years ago that America would reverse a great recession, reboot our auto industry, and unleash the longest stretch of job creation in our history, if I had told you that we would open up a new chapter with the Cuban people, shut down Iran's nuclear weapons program without firing a shot, take out the mastermind of 9/11, if I had told you that we would win marriage equality and secure the right to health insurance for another 20 million of our fellow citizens, if I had told you all that, you might have said our sights were set a little too high.
Acknowledging the current political divide in the country, Obama urged Americans to seek common ground with one another, saying that while democracy does not require uniformity, it does require a basic sense of solidarity. The president warned that the United States faces a series of threats to democracy, such as the nagging issues of economic and racial inequality.
If every economic issue is framed as a struggle between a hardworking white middle class and an undeserving minority, then workers of all shades are going to be left fighting for scraps while the wealthy withdraw further into their private enclaves.
But Obama said he was more optimistic about America now than when he took office and called on citizens to remain engaged in the democratic process.
I'm asking you to hold fast to that faith written into our founding documents, that idea whispered by slaves and abolitionists, that spirit sung by immigrants and homesteaders and those who marched for justice, that creed reaffirmed by those who planted flags from foreign battlefields to the surface of the moon, a creed at the core of every American whose story is not yet written. Yes, we can. Yes, we did. Yes, we can.
Richard Green, VOA News, Washington.
Some experts believe that Africa is likely to be low on the list of foreign policy priorities for the upcoming Donald Trump administration, but others say that U.S. policy goals for Africa enjoy steady bipartisan support. Dr. J. Peter Pham is the Vice President of the Atlantic Council and Director of its Africa Center. He explained to Mohammed El-Shenawy why the basic elements of U.S. policy towards Africa will not change under the new administration.
So I think we have to understand two different dynamics. One is that Africa policy in the United States has largely been characterized by continuity and broad bipartisan support. If one looks at almost every specific measure of policy, whether it be on trade, whether it be on security, whether it be on humanitarian issues, there's been broad continuity from the Clinton administration to George W. Bush through the Obama administration. And there's also been broad support from both parties. For example, 2 years ago when the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, the major piece of trade legislation concerning Africa, was renewed by the U.S. government, it passed both houses of Congress, both the House of Representatives and the Senate, by almost unanimous consent in both houses. I mean, there are literally only a handful of no votes on that measure, unlike other trade measures. So it gives you an example of the depth of bipartisan. So one has to acknowledge continuity and bipartisan support. On the other hand, certainly in any new administration, and certainly the Trump administration, there will be differences in accent, in tone, in priorities. But the strategic issues, I think, remain the same, perhaps a different notes of emphasis, a different way of doing things. But I think the basic interests of the United States remain unchanged.
But how could some of the presidential campaign pledges, such as banning Muslims, play into the propaganda of terrorist groups on the continent?
What is said during election campaigns and governing are two different things. That applies to whether it is President Trump coming in or President Obama 8 years ago or President Bush 8 years before that. I think one has to make that distinction. However, if there is going to be issues with the terrorists and jihadists, the issue is probably much more rooted. And these are people who are opposed to the United States and its allies before this election, and they remain so afterwards. And I think it's rather unnecessary to claim that they are different in their opposition. Perhaps they may try to use things that are said in their propaganda, but the fundamental fact remains there were threats before and there are threats after, and they have to be dealt with as threats.
What are your recommendations to deal with challenges facing the U.S. across Africa, like terrorism, post-intervention Libya, and other sources of instability in Africa, like South Sudan, torn by violent political infighting?
I would give several pieces of advice, both to the incoming administration and to U.S. allies. First and foremost, the first obligation of any government anywhere is to protect the safety and security of its citizens. So that has to be the first priority of the Trump administration, protecting American citizens and interests. It's the first priority of African countries. It's the first priority of our allies. So protect your citizens, deal with threats. Second thing, work with partners, especially partners who know the region well and have their own stake in it. And we have very strong partners in the region. You know, in North Africa and West Africa, we have Morocco, the first country to recognize American independence and one that has a very innovative approach to countering violent extremism, not only in its country, but in the region. And we have other partners. One of the first heads of state to speak to President-elect Trump was President El-Sisi of Egypt. So we have other partners in the region as well. And of course, we have our traditional allies. And the third point I would make, and this would be to our African friends, is one has to be proactive. Relationships take two sides, and so I would encourage them to also engage the new administration.
That was J. Peter Pham, a vice president of the Atlantic Council and director of its Africa Center. He was speaking with reporter Mohammed El-Shenawy.
Gambian President Yahya Jammeh remains defiant, rejecting calls to step down when his term ends next week. AFP now reports that he has fired 12 ambassadors who asked him to step aside and allow opposition leader Adama Barrow to be sworn in as the new president on January 19th. The ambassadors were sacked after sending a joint letter to the president. Jammeh is contesting the December 1st election results, citing alleged irregularities. He has taken his appeal to the country's Supreme Court. The court was supposed to meet yesterday, but there were not enough judges. The hearing was rescheduled for Monday, 3 days before Inauguration Day. However, the chief judge says the court probably won't meet until May. AFP reports that five judges from Nigeria and one from Sierra Leone were invited to hear the case, but none arrived in Banjul. The chief judge is the court's only sitting justice because the court has been dormant since May of last year. Some observers say members of Gambia's parliament may try to vote to extend Jammeh's mandate to keep him in power. You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib. 16 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. U.S. President Barack Obama has delivered his farewell address to the nation. And Gambian President Yahya Jammeh remains defiant, rejecting calls to step down when his term ends next week. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Amnesty International is calling for a national overhaul of the justice system in Central African Republic. It says dozens of people who have committed rape and other crimes during years of conflict live openly and with impunity. The human rights group is also urging the establishment of hybrid court or special criminal court to try those accused of war crimes. These and other recommendations are included in Amnesty's new report called The Long Wait for Justice, Accountability in Central African Republic. Erica Busse is a senior legal advisor with the group. From Dakar, she spoke with VOA's William Eagle about some of the alleged criminals who have yet to be arrested and proposals for a way forward.
Some of the people that are still at large who are suspected of committing crimes are Patrice Nagasona, who is the self-declared coordinator of the Anti-Bellica. There's also other high-profile ex-Bellica leaders, including Abdoulaye Hissène and Haroun Gaye. And finally, there's also former presidents Bozize and Jotodia, who are still at large. And of course, there are also many lower-level perpetrators who are also still at large. In the report, we outline many reasons why many of these perpetrators haven't been arrested. Part of it is just a difficulty given the security situation in the country and also just the weaknesses of the CAR police and judicial system in terms of their capacity to effect these arrests. Another issue is, of course, that because the justice system is very, very weak at the present point, even when some perpetrators are arrested, there's been some trials recently of some fairly high-level anti-Bellica commanders, which has led to their acquittal. Also, some who have cases against them haven't gone to trial, and their periods for pretrial detention have run out. So there's various problems that have led to this situation. However, there's been a lot of efforts towards establishing a special criminal court. And so there is some hope that in the future, some of these people will be arrested and tried.
With regard to the special criminal court, can you describe how it would work alongside the national justice system and also with, to some extent, the International Criminal Court, which I understand its role is a bit limited in this case?
It's a very interesting situation here where, you know, there's several different ways in which there is going to be accountability for these crimes. The ICC has launched an investigation into the crimes committed in the most recent conflict starting in 2012. Their investigation, as far as we understand, is quite advanced, and I would think that there probably will be arrest warrants that should be issued certainly during the course of next year. But of course, we don't know that for certain. The Special Criminal Court was established by a law in 2015. There was a lot of delay in terms of its establishment, but several things have been put in place. They have a building. They started the recruitment process for having international and national judges. And the special prosecutor is supposed to be appointed in the next couple of months. Although it has international and national personnel, it is in fact a court that's within the national justice system. So there is also hope that this would lead to the strengthening of the national justice system, and as well as, you know, the capacity building and skills transfer to the national judges and staff at this court. And then finally, there's the ordinary courts, which are, you know, at this point quite weak in terms of their capacity to hear, especially complicated crimes involving crimes under international law. In terms of how they all will work together, the special court has a provision saying that if the ICC is seized of a case, then it will defer to the ICC. So this is sort of the opposite of what would normally happen, which would be that the ICC would only take jurisdiction if the national courts wouldn't. So it'll be interesting to see how that works in practice. But I think there has already been, you know, a lot of discussions between the special criminal court and the ICC as to how they'll cooperate. I think, you know, the ICC is likely to only take a few cases, you know, two or three cases at the most. The special criminal court will probably take the remainder of the high-level perpetrators, and then it will be left to the ordinary courts to try the other perpetrators in the long term.
When would the special court begin working?
Some steps have already been taken for the recruitment. I think once the special prosecutor is in place, and again, hopefully in the next couple of months, investigations can begin. One of the interesting things about the structure of the special criminal court is that the investigations can begin before the entire court is in place. So we would hope that the investigations would start at some point next year.
Is the situation in the CAR similar to that of Rwanda? Can any comparison be made? For example, is there a need for a local courts, such as Rwanda had Gacaca courts, to try people? Or are there perhaps not as many people that are enjoying impunity, and therefore one could not compare the cases?
It's always hard to, you know, compare the scale of the conflict. I don't think that in the CAR there will be, you know, a system such as the Gacaca. That's not really being envisaged. But there is definitely a need to have, you know, domestic proceedings, because there, you know, there really are quite a large number of perpetrators, and, you know, the ICC can only handle a few. Even the special criminal court will be limited. And also in the longer term, the special criminal court is only supposed to be operational for 5 years with, it can be renewed, but that may not be enough time also to try all of the perpetrators. In terms of mobile courts, that is something that, you know, has worked, for example, in the Democratic Republic of Congo. There's been quite a successful mobile court program from the military courts to try perpetrators of international crimes. This is something that could potentially be replicated in CAR as a way of also, you know, being able to go to where the crimes were committed. At present, there is a limited amount of mobile courts, but much more for civil affairs, for again, just trying to rebuild the rule of law courts that will give birth certificates and things of that sort. But I think that's also quite important also to just show people, especially in some of the more remote areas or where areas where security has been a problem, where there's really been a complete absence of the rule of law, to show that there are courts and that they are operational. So I think that's also an important first step.
That was Erica Busse, a senior legal advisor with Amnesty International. She was speaking with VOA reporter William Eagle.
A medical aid group says thousands of refugees on the Greek islands and in Serbia are suffering below freezing temperatures. Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, says thousands are living in flimsy tents or abandoned buildings. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
Doctors Without Borders says there are 16,000 refugees on the Greek islands, double the capacity of camps or shelters there. Having fled from Syria, Iraq and Afghanistan for the most part, they're waiting for the Greek government to decide on their asylum claims. Last year, the European Union and Turkey reached an agreement to try to stop the flow of refugees into Greece. Those who reached the islands after March 20th had to remain there and apply for asylum. But processing their applications has been very slow. Prior to that, most arrivals had been brought to the Greek mainland. There are about 55,000 refugees and migrants on the mainland living in camps. They're allowed to stay, but the fate of those on the islands is not clear. MSF humanitarian worker Louise Roland Goslin is helping the refugees.
They're living crammed just in tents, in flimsy tents. They often have little access to hot water. They have little care, little protection, and this has a direct impact on their health. And what we've seen over the last few months, a real deterioration of people's mental health status. People saying that they feel very depressed, very worried, because the conditions are just so harsh.
Recently, the Greek government touted its efforts to winterize the refugee camps on the mainland. But Roland Goslin says that did not happen in all the mainland camps, and not on such islands as Lesbos and Samos.
Men, women, and children are sleeping in sub-zero temperatures, in the snow in Lesbos, in the pouring rain in Samos. And believe me, it's extremely cold when you're there.
She says one snowy night in Athens, as she put her child to sleep, she thought about refugee parents trying to do the same on the Greek islands. It's not a matter of living, she says, but surviving. Refugees built fires inside their tents, putting themselves and their families at risk.
So these are the kinds of choices that people are facing at the moment. And as a humanitarian organization, yes, we're providing medical care. We're distributing blankets. We're trying to propose a temporary shelter. We're doing everything we can. We can only mildly alleviate their suffering. We cannot end their suffering.
Roland Goslin says it's up to the Greek government to end their suffering. She says Doctors Without Borders cannot tell the government to relocate the refugees from the islands. However, she says, it's unlikely any action will be taken soon to improve conditions there. Doctors Without Borders is providing medical, reproductive health, and psychological care to the refugees. Meanwhile, the group is also warning about conditions for refugees in Serbia. It says more than 7,500 people are stranded there, living in overcrowded camps and informal settlements. MSF says about 2,000 young people are living in abandoned buildings in Belgrade in sub-freezing temperatures. Most are from Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Pakistan. MSF has distributed emergency space heaters to some, but it's calling on the Serbian government to provide more shelters. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
In related news, AP reports the Greek Navy has sent a tank landing ship to the island of Lesbos to act as a temporary shelter. It's expected to house about 500 migrants. And Germany says there are about 280,000 new arrivals last year. That's well below the 890,000 migrants and refugees who arrived in 2015. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Joe Gill, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, a discussion on the challenges of political transitions in Africa, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Tanzania, and Gambia, to name a few. Right here, on the next Straight Talk Africa, at 18:30 UTC.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
VOA News.
VOA. When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.